Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Over My Dead Pond. This is your host for today, Kate Carter.
I'm Kylie Caldwell.
And I'm Holly Spear.
The gang is back. Gang, gang. Okay, so I've got a story for you guys today. I got a good one. Per usual, we're just going to jump right in. This is a case that you both know. It is also a case I would say probably most true crime lovers know as well. Probably most just regular people too, if you really want to get into it. So here we go. On a quiet August morning in 2018, a family vanished from a regular suburban street that looked exactly like every other street in America. A husband stood in his driveway, arms crossed, pleading for his family's safe return on the local news. His voice was calm and steady, and his concern for his family was perfectly rehearsed. But inside the family's home, there was no signs of struggle. There was no broken glass, no forced entry, just an eerie silence. As investigators began peeling back the layers of life that looked pristine from the outside and on social media, they uncovered lies on top of lies. They uncovered a marriage unraveling behind walls and a timeline that made absolutely no sense. By the time the truth came around, it would become one of the most chilling cases of family annihilation in modern true crime history. This was committed by a man the world would come to know as Chris Watts.
Shut up.
All right, so before we even get into like what Chris Watts did or who he is and stuff like that, I want to talk about his background, because this case in media and still to this day was kind of like unsettling for multiple reasons. But specifically one thing is that there was really nothing about Chris that screamed family killer. You know, he didn't have a violent past. He wasn't a criminal. He wasn't known to have a temper, and honestly, no one really could have told you that something was wrong with him or going on in his family. He was pretty much a boring person, which is kind of what ended up being the problem to begin with. So Chris was born in 1985 in North Carolina, though we North Carolinians don't claim him at all. He grew up in a pretty normal working class family. Both of his parents are around. He had a sister. There wasn't any major trauma that anyone knows of. Like I said, he didn't have a criminal background or history, and there weren't really any red flags for me to wave either. Everyone who knew him or knew of him described him in the same way. He was a quiet dude, very polite, easygoing, kind of kept to himself, which sounds fine until you realize that this dude pretty much had no emotions. He never argued. He wasn't an assertive person. And he didn't ever talk about having like strong opinions on things, which works great when you're a kid, but not so much when you're an adult with wife, kids, and a life that you secretly hated. Chris pretty much learned early on that the easiest way to get through life, or at least his life, was just to say okay and let other people decide things. He didn't want any conflict. He wasn't in a confrontation. He just wanted things to be smooth and easy. And that's kind of how resentment grows. So enter his wife. People have mispronounced her name a lot because it looks like Shannon, but it's Shanann. Chris met Shanann Ruzick online in 2010. And if you know anything about this case, you will already know that Shanann was pretty much the complete opposite of Chris. She was outspoken. She was very confident, opinionated, and a social butterfly. She was not the type of person who was like waiting around for shit to happen. She would go and do it. And honestly, Chris loved that, at least at first. So the pair got married in 2012 and they moved to Colorado together, where they bought a giant house in a town called Frederick. It was a house that they definitely couldn't afford, but from the outside, the new Watts family looked very Instagram perfect. And I mean literally Instagram perfect, because Shanann documented everything. Their house, their trips, their kids, their marriage. And Chris was always there in the background, just smiling, agreeing, being quiet. But behind the scenes, as we now know sometimes happens, the cracks were kind of already there. Remembering what I said earlier, Chris wasn't an abusive type. He wasn't aggressive or controlling, but he was just kind of absent. He was like a smile and nod kind of husband, but emotionally, he just wasn't checked in. He didn't see marriage or his kids as things he actively chose to be a part of every day. He pretty much saw them as things that like happened to him. Like, I happen to get married. I happen to have kids. And when you live like that, you don't problem solve the issues. You pretty much just fantasize of how to escape it. So Chris and Shanann had two kids together. They were two daughters, Bella and Celeste, aka Cece. So Bella and Cece. And by all appearances, Chris was a great dad, or he looked like a great dad. He played with them, took pictures with them, put them to bed, did all the fun stuff. But people who really paid attention eventually noticed that Chris related to his kids the same way he related to everything else, which was just very surface level. Like, there was no emotions behind it. And by 2015, the Watts were drowning financially. It actually got so bad that they had to file for bankruptcy. They had maxed out credit cards and mortgage payments were late, but still they had that perfect image, especially on social media. They always had new clothes. They went on family trips, and Shanann's Instagram was always flowing with pictures and videos of them enjoying their lives. Now, let me talk about Shanann for a little bit, because I've definitely noticed over the years, especially at the beginning, this case kind of gets unfair to Shanann really fast if people don't understand who she like was. That being said, I do want to make it very clear, nothing about Shanann caused this case to happen. Chris Watts did not do what he did because his wife was bossy or controlling. In fact, that narrative has kind of been spread like that. It's a super lazy, sexist, wildly incorrect narrative. Shanann was a very kind of specific personality, and that does matter to the dynamic of who her and Chris were together. So Shanann Ruzick was born in 1984 in Jersey, but she primarily grew up in Aberdeen, North Carolina. So another North Carolinian. Shanann was very close to her family, especially her parents. Family was a very important thing to Shanann. That's something you'll see constantly, like in her social media posts or in text messages. And it was just like the way she lived her life in general. She was not a quiet person and was not passive like her husband. She was not the kind of person that blended into the background either. She was a talker. She loved to plan things, a fixer, a doer. All of that being said, with her personality, Shanann also did have legitimate health issues going on as well, which a lot of people don't know about. But unfortunately, she dealt with lupus, which for those that don't know, is a chronic autoimmune disease where a person's immune system pretty much mistakenly attacks its own body and organs. So that can cause like really bad chronic pain and fatigue. And it's also something that's heavily misdiagnosed a lot. So to get diagnosed with lupus is pretty hard. Shanann having lupus actually shaped a lot of her view on the world. She was super vocal about her physical and mental struggles, but she was also extremely motivated to like stay positive, productive with her family, and wanting to find like the good in it all kind of thing. So let's talk about her social media life. If you know this case at all, you know that her Facebook was pretty much a full-time job for her. She documented everything: marriage, kids, daily routines, work life, health journey, everything. To some people, that was annoying. To others, inspirational. And to Shanann, it was both a community for her and income, because she worked for a company called Thrive, which is a multi-level marketing company. This whole social media documentation thing wasn't just like a side hustle for her. It was pretty much everything.
So many people are social media influencers and like document every second of their lives. But I feel like this was kind of like, she was one of like the first wave of people that was doing this. So it wasn't as popular as it is now.
Shanann was kind of in it, you know? She was definitely one of those people that documenting her family in 2014, you know, was not normal. So I'm sure on Facebook, some people were like, absolutely not. That's hella annoying. And then we've seen so many documentaries about like the good and bad of some women and documenting their families online. Her whole documenting everything on social media was basically her job and her life. And her husband, well, he was what people called an MLM husband, which is a multi-level marketing husband. He pretty much was just a face in all the posts, always smiling, agreeing, holding a kid, or just doing whatever Shanann needed. And if you watch the videos or like look at the pictures that Shanann posted, Chris looks fine in all of them, but he doesn't look like thrilled or horribly miserable or just forced to be there. He was just fine. He was just there, you know? And because of this, Chris and Shanann's marriage worked in a very specific way. Shanann basically led and Chris followed. She handled all the family schedules, the finances, did the planning and decisions, and then Chris just executed it. If something needed to be done, Chris would do it. If something needed to be decided, Shanann would decide. And so honestly, like that worked for their marriage. Chris didn't want the big responsibility for like emotional decisions, but he still wanted the structure. And that was also part of the ever-growing problem that they have is that when a partner doesn't participate in decisions, they don't feel like they have ownership on their life. So Chris didn't feel like Shanann's partner. He felt more like an employee or a roommate. But instead of speaking up and saying something about it, he just did nothing. You know, Shanann never thought she was controlling him. She thought she was just married to a man who happened to always just agree. And honestly, that's what he told her too. Let's talk about finances, because that's really where the Watts family, like things got shooketh. The Watts bought this huge house in Frederick, Colorado, like I said, and it was something that they absolutely could not afford long term. Shanann loved the house. It was part of that whole like family image she was doing. But by 2015, reality had caught up and they had to file for bankruptcy. Their credit card debt was massive. Bills were piling up on the kitchen table. Their HOA payments were completely behind and their mortgage was constantly at risk. But yet, nothing changed in their day-to-day lives. Shanann's posts were still upbeat and positive. Financial spending continued on, but Chris never pushed back. And so this is kind of where I think the resentment started to come through for a lot of things. Chris didn't feel stressed out. He felt trapped, but he never said anything to anyone, especially Shanann. By late 2017, early 2018, people who were close to Shanann began noticing that something was off. It was not with her, though. Chris was becoming more and more distant. He was being less affectionate and overall like less engaging in pretty much everything. And don't get me wrong, Shanann did notice it too, but she was trying to fix it. She suggested therapy. She asked him what was wrong. She tried to communicate with him, but Chris always gave very vague answers like, oh, I don't know, or I'm just tired kind of excuses. That being said, inside, Chris had already started like pulling away. Not physically, but he was just disconnecting himself from everyone and everything. And while Shanann believed her and Chris were working just through a rough patch, Chris pretty much had known for years that he was wanting out. Okay, so early 2018, Shanann became pregnant with their third child, a little boy, who they planned on naming Nico. But instead of that bringing Shanann and Chris closer, her pregnancy pushed Chris even further away because now in his mind, an escape kind of felt harder to do. You know, kids are kind of a hard decision on that part. This is really where the story starts to accelerate because up until now, Chris Watts, you know, he's unhappy, he's resentful, he's passive, kind of checked out emotionally, but none of that actually equals murder. What changes this case is that Chris didn't just want out, he wanted basically a replacement life. And that replacement has a name. Her name was Nicole Kessinger. So Nicole worked at the same company as Chris. She was single, independent, didn't have kids, didn't have a mortgage, no shared bank accounts, no school schedules, no daycare pickups, nothing. She was described as confident, outdoorsy, spontaneous, and really focused on her self-growth in her life. She wasn't really looking to be someone's second priority or interested in playing that whole stepmom role. She wanted a partner who was available, and Chris presented himself like that. So the two of them began talking in June of 2018 while Shanann was pregnant. At first, it was super casual, as I say in air quotes, casual. It was work conversations, shared interests, but things started escalating quickly. Within a few weeks, they were already meeting up to have sex. They were going on public dates, spending the nights together and acting like a couple. And something important to mention is that Chris did not present himself to Nicole as a married man who was like trying to figure out things. In fact, he had told Nicole that he was separated from Shanann and that their marriage was over because she was, quote unquote, controlling. So at that point, they were like only co-parenting, according to Nicole. But of course, none of that was actually true. And according to Nicole, Chris was different with her than what everybody else had described him as. He wasn't quiet or passive or boring. He was actually very attentive to her, engaging, sexual, present. You know, he was constantly texting her, talking about his feelings, blah, 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 vomit, vomit. What we see with Nicole basically is Chris was capable of having emotions and emotional connections. He just kind of was choosing of where he wanted to place it. And in this case, he placed it completely outside of his family and with Nicole. He would go camping with her. He'd go hiking, spontaneous plans. But Chris always said, oh, he never got to do those kind of things. Well, he could have done those things with Shanann and his family. He just chose not to. So instead of owning that, Chris decided to rewrite his life. Suddenly in his mind, you know, he's having all this fun with Nicole. So Shanann's the problem. And the kids are the obstacles, you know, like these people basically had stolen his life from him over what he could have had. And once you stop seeing people as people, you know, like seeing them as barriers, you can pretty much just justify anything.
This whole time, he's doing absolutely nothing to make his life better.
No, not at all.
He's just like, I'm going to get a new life.
While still his wife is pregnant and he's got two little kids at home. While pregnant, Shanann and the two girls were away in North Carolina for a few weeks. This was summer of 2018. Chris was fully living his double life. During this time, police would later find that Nicole Kessinger had been Googling things on her personal laptop like marrying your mistress. How long do men stay with mistresses? And the man I'm having an affair with says he'll leave his wife. So obviously she knew.
Yeah.
Right?
If you're Googling that, you have to know that he's still with his wife.
I love the things that people Google.
Yes. And here's a little PSA for all of our listeners. Whatever you Google, no matter how many times you delete your searches or wipe out your, it can be found. Okay. So if you look up like how to bury a body in your backyard, it's got to be found if you're ever in trouble and the police need to search your computer. Just saying. Meanwhile, while all this is going on with Nicole's computer that the police later found, on Chris's computer, they were finding searches like local apartments, wedding dresses, romantic getaways. The two of them are just doing their own shit. While all of that's going on, Shanann isn't oblivious. She definitely like felt the distance. I mean, she's with the girls in North Carolina for weeks while Chris is just staying home. And on top of that, Chris like stopped saying, I love you. He refused to acknowledge Shanann or want to be in the same room with her. And he even stopped responding to like texts and phone calls. So obviously Shanann's like panicking. She's sending these long texts asking what's wrong, asking if there's someone else. And this entire time, Chris is responding to her with stupid things like, I just need space, or I don't know. During that few weeks separation where they were in two different states really became a critical part of this case, because during that time, Chris was able to experience what his life would be like without his actual family in it. And he unfortunately liked it. No kids were waking him up. There were no responsibilities after work. There were no bills to stress over, no emotional labor. Just Nicole, sex, fun, freedom. And once Shanann reminds Chris about her and the girls coming back home to Colorado soon, Chris begins doing things that only make sense if he's mentally removing himself from his family. He stops engaging, he stops caring, and he completely detaches himself from them. And here's the thing, Chris Watts never snapped like the people we tend to talk about. He pretty much transitioned. And by the time Shanann and the girls were boarding their flight home on August 12th, 2018, Chris had already decided that he wanted a life where his family didn't exist. Oh, I forgot to mention this too, that after North Carolina, so like they're flying home, Shanann and the girls, Shanann drops the girls off at home and she immediately hops back on a flight to Arizona for 2 days for a business trip. When Shanann's flight lands back home on the night of August 12th, a friend drops her off at home around 1:48 a.m. There's doorbell camera footage showing her walking inside her house. You can tell on the footage she's exhausted and she had an OB appointment the next morning super early. So she just goes upstairs and gets ready for bed. At this point, around 2 a.m., Chris is still awake And this is important because Chris later claims that once Shanann got home, they had a quote, emotional conversation that night, and that Shanann had confronted him and threatened to take the girls away so that he could never see them again. But yet we have zero evidence to support that, which doesn't really matter anyways, because Chris will go on to change his story a million times. We do know this, though. Shanann was still alive when she entered that house on the early morning of August 12th, but after that, she never walked back out. So we're now at Monday, August 13th, and on paper, this is supposed to be a normal weekday morning. Chris goes to work. Shanann has an OB appointment. Life continues on, except it doesn't. At this point, Shanann is in her second trimester of pregnancy, and like I said, her doctor's appointment was scheduled for that morning, and it's one that she was a little nervous for, and she had mentioned that to some friends, but Shanann never showed up to the appointment. And when the doctor's office calls Shanann to see if she's going to be late, her phone immediately goes to voicemail and any texts go unanswered, which obviously we know is an immediate problem. But to Shanann as well, she wasn't the type of person to go MIA. You know, she was like glued to her phone, social media, all that stuff. She didn't miss appointments. And one person knew that more than anyone, which was a woman named Nicole Atkinson. So Nicole wasn't just a friend to Shanann. She was her best friend and also happened to be a coworker. They talked all day, every day. So when Shanann doesn't respond to Nicole's text that morning, Nicole immediately gets uneasy. After hours pass with still no responses, no movements, no calls, also no social media posts, Nicole decides to get in her car and she drives straight to the Watts house. And when Nicole gets to their house, she immediately notices that something's off. Shanann's car is in the garage and the house is locked and no one answers the front door. This alone made no sense for Nicole. Shanann doesn't go anywhere without her car. She loved to drive. So Nicole immediately calls Chris and Chris pulls into the driveway a few minutes later. But from the second he arrives, things felt weird. Chris wasn't frantic. He wasn't worried. He goes on to unlock the front door and him and Nicole go inside. And that's where the red flags start. So inside the house, Nicole notices that Shanann's purse is on the counter and her phone is inside the purse. Her shoes are by the front door and the girls' blankets that they always take in the car are still in the kitchen. So it's pretty clear to Nicole that Shanann didn't leave the house. And she actually said that out loud to Chris too. And then out of nowhere, Chris begins talking a lot and none of it's making any sense. So Chris tells Nicole and later the police that Shanann took the girls to a friend's house, but he doesn't know whose house it is and doesn't know why Shanann left her phone. And he doesn't know why her purse is there. And he doesn't know why she missed her OB appointment that morning. He just says, not sure. I don't know. He shrugs a lot. Chris isn't panicking at all, but he is pacing and at some moments even smiling. It's almost like Chris is trying to convince people of something, but someone who's terrified that his family is potentially gone, Nicole isn't buying it. And so this is when she calls the police.
I've seen so many documentaries on this case and Nicole, the BFF, she is the best BFF.
Oh my God. She immediately jumps on it.
Yeah. She's not putting up with his bullshit. She knows something's up.
Yeah. So when police officers arrive to do a welfare check on Shanann and the girls, their body cameras are on, which we know in this case, thank God, because the particular footage, which Kylie was kind of just talking about, it ended up going viral and it becomes really crucial to the case later on. So as the police arrive, Chris meets them in the driveway and he's smiling. Inside the house, officers begin asking questions and Chris immediately fills in the silence with like rambling explanations. But he also just keeps repeating, quote, she left with the kids. But Chris still can't explain where, why or how. I mean, Shanann's car is literally in the garage. And the officers are noticing the exact same things that Nicole did. After asking the basic questions, the police ask Chris if any neighbors have cameras. And Chris is actually like, yeah, they do. So the police follow him next door. And on the neighbor's security screen, they are able to see footage from that early morning. Chris's truck backed into the Watts' driveway, something he never did. And Chris can be seen loading things into the back of his truck and then pulling out of the driveway. There was no footage of Shanann or the girls ever leaving. And when the police look over at Chris while watching the footage, it's very visibly written on his face that he can tell his story is not holding up. Back at the Watts' house, Chris is now unraveling. He's sweating. He's talking more than ever, and he avoids eye contact. So later that day, Chris begins giving interviews to local news stations. And every time in the interviews, he's just standing in front of his house talking about how much he wants his family back. And honestly, they're very uncomfortable interviews to watch.
My favorite part of the body cam footage is when they're at the neighbor's house and he's like pulling up his cameras on the TV. And obviously, Chris gets very nervous. But then when he walks away, the neighbor is like, this is fishy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's like the best part. Yeah. Or he says something like, he doesn't normally act like this. Like, he's acting weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the police, which is great. Okay, so by the end of the same day, Monday, August 13th, this is no longer a missing person situation. Now, the police aren't saying that out loud yet, but the shift has definitely happened. Chris is not being treated like a worried husband anymore. In fact, he's being treated like the only person who knows what actually happened. And here's the best part about Chris is he can't lie under pressure, which is very fortunate for us. So before I get into the interrogation room interview, which is another fabulous interview to watch, I do want to talk about the TV interview, which happened to be one of the most self-incriminating things that Chris ended up doing. Now, Chris was totally open to speaking to local news, but it's definitely weird that he does it on the exact same day that his family goes missing, because you think there would be like some type of like break first. Like, if somebody goes missing, the media come to interview you, normally the reaction is like, we're looking for, you know, my child. I'm super worried. If you're out there, if you can hear me. And like, Chris doesn't do any of that. He's kind of joking around on the interviews, which is very creepy. Hands on his hips, smiling, rocking back and forth. He's saying all the right words technically, but like, there's nothing behind it, like no emotion, no crying, no sad faces. And at one point he's like laughing too with the interviewer. And it's not really because something's funny, but he's more so like feeling uncomfortable in the moment.
We always say like, you can't judge how people grieve, you know, yeah. Or like what they do afterwards when a traumatic situation happens like that. But in this case, or in some cases, yeah, you totally you can.
Yeah. I mean, literally everyone who watched this interview at home while it was going on clocked it immediately too. It was not how a man acted when his pregnant wife and kids were missing. And like, everybody kind of zoned in on it. Mm-hmm. So on August 14th, the next day, Chris agrees to go to the police station for an interview. But it's important to note that Chris was not under arrest yet. He's not handcuffed. He literally walked in totally willing on his own. And that's because Chris still thinks he can like talk his way out of this. So he sits down with investigators and he immediately starts over explaining without even being asked. He's repeating the same story over and over that Shanann took the kids to a friend's house. But yet he still has no answers for like who the friends were. What were they doing there? How did they get there? And the investigators, well, they did a great job at letting Chris talk. He tells them about his marriage issues, how Shanann was emotional, how he was confused in his life. But when the investigators do start asking questions, Chris pretty much tries to dodge all of them. Where are the kids' car seats? In the house. Why didn't Shanann take her phone? Don't know. Why didn't she text or tell anyone? I don't know. Not sure. Why is her car still at the house? Couldn't tell you. So at this point, Chris begins visibly sweating. He's constantly wiping his hands on his pants in the video, and he's also rocking back and forth. And that's the moment that the police bring up his affair. The investigators ask Chris if there's someone else in the picture, and he pauses for a second and then very calmly says yes. Which is like a huge moment in the case. Police now know that he had a motive to lie. He had a motive to leave or hide things. But obviously, Chris tries to frame the affair as irrelevant or not part of the issue. At some point after this, police ask Chris if he's willing to take a polygraph test, which he agrees to. I don't need to say shit on that. But the answers that Chris gave kind of threw everyone for a loop. It literally doesn't make any sense. So he was asked three direct questions, and Chris answered yes to all of them. So those three questions were, did you physically harm Shanann? Yes. Do you know where your children are? Yes. Are you telling the truth? Yes. Which makes no sense, but yet the polygraph results come back as deception indicated. So like after the test happens, the examiner sits down with Chris and says, yeah, you didn't pass, though he said yes to all of that. And so for some reason, this is like what broke Chris, and he starts to cry. So that's the first time he emotionally like shows anything in this case.
Well, that just goes to show you how messed up these polygraph exams are.
It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense. He doesn't pass. He says yes to everything. And then he's like, I guess he just thinks if he keeps changing his story that it's going to be okay. But I don't know why the polygraph is the one that broke it for him, but it did. And that's when he like breaks down. And honestly, it's not even like he's crying because his family's gone. He's crying because he knows like this is the beginning of the end kind of thing for him.
Oh yeah. Like, I don't think he wasn't crying when he gave the interview. He wasn't crying when he, you know, gave the statement to police or the public, but he's going to cry when he gets caught. So that just shows you who Chris Watts is.
Yeah. After the polygraph, that's when Chris decides to confess, but only to the part of the story that makes him look the least bad. So Chris tells police that Shanann killed the girls, that he walked into a room at their house and found her on top of them. And in a fit of rage, he then killed Shanann, which is like a classic move. We like to call this a partial confession. It's where someone admits to doing something horrible, but also shifts the blame to somewhere else for the worst part, basically. But thank God the investigators did not believe Chris for a second. But in this moment, they don't argue with him or tell him that he's wrong. They just let him talk. On August 15th, Chris is arrested and is initially charged with first-degree murder and unlawful termination of a pregnancy. But yet, Shanann hasn't been found. No one's found Bella or Cece either. The police know that Chris is lying, but they don't know where his family is. And that's what really matters, is because we know when people go missing, especially a pregnant wife and children, time is pretty much everything to a case. So the investigators start looking at Chris's phone locations, data, truck GPS, and his movement leading up to the morning of Shanann and the girls disappearing. And one place stands out immediately. There was a work site, an oil site, that Chris had been scheduled to visit that morning. But it wasn't a random site or a last minute visit. It was one that Chris had actually scheduled himself. So now we kind of understand that the neighbor's camera footage was going to make more sense. So investigators headed out to this oil site, which was a remote industrial area with massive oil tanks, limited access, and pretty much no foot traffic. This wasn't just a place that you would stumble upon, but it was a place you would go on purpose to. And as police searched the area, they noticed right away there were some disturbed ground not too far away from some of the tanks. And that's exactly where they ended up finding Shanann. She had been buried in a shallow grave. In that moment, everything about this case changed permanently, because now the police know two things. Chris has lied about everything, and Shanann's death was not an accident. But Bella and Cece are still missing. So the investigators and police began focusing on the tanks near where Shanann's body was found. There are these massive sealed containers that were filled with oil. And as horrible as it sounds, the police quickly realized that they needed to look inside the tanks, which obviously is going to take some time. It takes pretty special equipment and extreme care to get these tanks opened. But when they finally are, they do find Bella and Cece, each in a separate tank of their own. Fast forward now, a few months later, investigators sit down with Chris again, but this time from prison. There's no pretending from Chris now. He knows that they know everything. And this is when he finally tells the story without trying to soften it or redirect the blame. Chris admits that Shanann never hurt the girls, but he did in fact kill her. And that when he did, the girls were still alive, and he didn't make the decision until they were at the oil site in regards to ending their lives as well. So Chris eventually pleads guilty to the murder of Shanann, the murders of Bella and Cece, and the unlawful termination of Shanann's pregnancy. And he's immediately sentenced to prison for life without the possibility of parole. Now, here's the thing that throws a lot of people off in the Chris Watts case. There was never really a trial. There was no jury, no dramatic cross-examination that we go into, no day in court kind of moment. And that's because each of the four charges that Chris was being charged with came with multiple aggravating factors, This was a case that the death penalty was eligible in Colorado, and prosecutors were pretty open from the beginning with Chris and his team that this wasn't maybe a death penalty case. This was going to be a death penalty case. So pretty much if this case had gone to trial, this is what would have happened. One, every detail of Shanann's death would have been described publicly. Two, the girls' deaths would have been explained to a jury. Three, photos from the oil site would have been shown. Four, Chris's Google searches, texts, and affair details would be read out loud. And five, his changing of confessions would be dissected from in front of everybody. And all of that matters because Shanann's family would have had to sit through all of it for weeks, potentially months. And that's kind of the leverage that the prosecutors ended up using. So in November of 2018, the prosecutors made Chris Watts an offer. They offered for him to plead guilty to all counts, to waive his rights to a trial, for him to get life in prison without the possibility of parole. And in that case, if he did all of that, the death penalty would be taken off the table. And honestly, this wasn't like to give leeway or mercy towards Chris, but it was more so there was just so much evidence against him that by doing a whole trial would have just like re-traumatized everyone. So once Chris took this or got this offer, he accepted it immediately, which like kind of tells you something.
Yeah, obviously he did. He's so
even his team told him like, this isn't a maybe death penalty. This is a death penalty case. Once Chris appears in court to enter his guilty plea, he just stands there quietly the entire time. Other than the words guilty, he shows almost no emotions. He gave no explanations, no excuses, and didn't ask to say any words of like condolences or anything to the family. That being said, Shanann's family did decide to give victim impact statements. During them, they talked about Shanann as a daughter, both Bella and Cece as little kids with these amazing personalities and habits, and how all three of their futures had been taken away. And then, completely unexpected, Shanann's parents decided something that no one imagined was going to happen. They decided to publicly forgive Chris. Not because he deserved it, but because they didn't want to carry that hatred for him forever. And in the end, Chris Watts was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for each murder. All of his sentences were to be served consecutively, meaning he will die in prison. Once the sentencing is over, technically, that's the end of the case. Case closed. There's no appeals, no parole hearings, nothing. But that's not really where this story ends. And that's because once Chris is locked away, he begins to talk. Chris was transferred out of a Colorado prison pretty quickly for his own safety and ended up in a maximum security prison in Wisconsin. Within months, he started writing these letters. He wrote them to strangers, to women, to people who, quote, wanted to understand him and what he did. Chris begins to reframe everything. He talks about finding religion and how he's trying to be forgiven by God and how he wants to help others now and he's owning what he's done. But if you actually read what he says in these letters, and some of them are publicly online, there's still something missing because all of these letters, he's talking about himself, his pain, his regret, and he's never really talking about Shanann or his two daughters. In February 2019, investigators interview Chris from prison, where he finally admits that his original story was a lie. You know, no shit. But in this interview, he's emotionless, and it's also casual. Like, he's talking like it's just talking to a friend. He explains what happened like something very normal, like a normal story of going to the grocery store, you know? After that interview, it was noticed that Chris had more fans than normal. Like, not normal, but we talk about this every once in a while, but like, people are obsessed. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes I am, but not in this level. We're obsessed with true crime. We're not obsessed with the person as a killer themselves. But like some women and men find it attractive to murders and serial killers and shit like that. And so after Chris had done this 2019 interview, he became like very popular to some people. I don't know how to like say that. But you get what I'm saying? Like some women love it.
Yeah, very strange people.
He had all these women that would write to him and people who truly believed he had changed or thought that Chris had been manipulated into killing Shanann and the girls, you know? And Chris would respond to all these letters and he never shut anything down, but he didn't like reject it in any type of way either. Like he loved the attention. Yeah. And to this day, he still accepts all forms of communication.
Seek help.
I'm going to send him some hate mail.
Yeah, we should. Just like.
Yeah.
Okay. So Shanann's family. Shanann's parents take custody of Bella and Cece's remains, and they begin their journey of grieving, both publicly and privately. They began advocating for domestic violence awareness and how there's different ways for things to be seen. They try to correct misinformation being spread about their daughter's and granddaughter's case, and they defend their daughter, Shanann, constantly. But like I said before, too, they also forgave Chris, and they continue to state that they do. But they make it known that this doesn't mean they excuse what Chris did. They just refuse to let it define the rest of their lives. Chris Watts didn't look like a monster. And that's honestly a part that still messes with people to this day about this case. There was no dramatic spiral, no warning. There was just a man who didn't want to deal with the life he built and chose the most permanent exit possible. Shanann, Bella, and Cece didn't die because of rage or madness. They were killed because accountability from Chris felt harder to do than just getting rid of them. In this case, evil does exist, but sometimes it just looks boring, quiet, and honestly painfully ordinary, just like Chris Watts. And that is our Watts story.
I think that's the scariest part, is that he wasn't like an abusive monster on the outside. Like there's no like
in any manner.
He's just a quiet dude who hated his family, and he's planning this in the background. Like you don't, yeah. You never know what people are thinking.
Like that's the scary part, is that he wasn't this big monster. He didn't have a traumatic upbringing, you know, like he was a very ordinary. And like I said, multiple times, he was boring. He was just his whole life and his existence was just boring.
He's going to be bored as hell in prison
for the rest of his life. So you guys want to jump into overtime? All right, Kylie, you got something for us today.
Yes, I saw this on TikTok. It said, if you could commit one crime without ever being caught, would you? And if so, which one and why? And I kind of took it like one crime, but you can commit it however many times as you want.
Oh.
It's just one crime you can never be caught for.
Okay, follow-up questions. Do people in the police know that you commit these crimes, but like you're not going to get in trouble for them?
No, I would take it as like, even if you go and shoot someone like in a crowded area, everyone's memory is just like wiped of it.
If you have to commit crimes, plural, to get to this one crime, am I overthinking?
I think you're overthinking it.
Okay.
So like mine, I would want to be like a hacker. I'm going in, I'm wiping everyone's student loans. I'm hacking the banks. I'm making my account nice and fat. You know, I'm hacking everything.
Okay, so hacking is a broad thing.
Dang, Kylie, that's a good one.
That is a good one. I wouldn't have thought about that. I mean, you guys know what mine immediately goes to in my head.
Murder.
I'd be killing people for sure. But I wouldn't be killing like regular schmegular people. I wouldn't be killing Cameron or any. Well, but what was that guy in North Little Rock that was like trying to find the bad people?
You're going to be a vigilante killer.
I'm going to be a vigilante killer. Yeah. It sounds fun in my head. I don't know if I could actually do that. The second thing that pops up is I would do like some big ass tax evasion kind of shit where I would get lots of money. But I kind of like yours better where it's just all remote.
Kate, you could be like a person that commits crimes and frames it on the people that need to be put away, you know?
Yeah.
Like you got those killers out there that we know they did it, but you can't prove it. Kate could go and commit a crime, frame them. That can be really fun.
Yeah.
I feel like
that sounds better than murdering people.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people deserve it, but I think mine would probably be like, I think it would be like a card counter or like something
like at a casino.
Yeah. Or like know the winning numbers of a lottery ticket. I feel like I'm talking about time travel now, and this is the question.
I would like to fly,
but I feel like I would know the answers to something.
Okay, now we're talking like powers.
Okay, yeah.
Kylie's gonna read minds.
Wait, what was the question?
Holly's just gonna know the future, and I'm gonna fly.
But how fun would that be?
Because now it's changing. So no, because I'm like, what if you had a photographic memory? But that's also not what we're talking. That's not a crime.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Okay. I get
you're a scammer. You're a scammer.
I want to be a scammer. I think maybe I should, but I don't want to scam people. Maybe I want to be a hacker with Kylie, actually.
Yeah. Let's all change to Kylie's side. That's the best one.
After this, we need to look into some like coding classes or something. We got to learn how to hack.
Yeah. What are those movies with those? For everyone that knows me, I'm really bad with movies. And okay, there's like multiple movies and it's big named actors and they're like breaking into casinos.
Like Ocean's 11.
Yes, the Oceans. I feel like that could be us.
How fun would that be? Like people, you're winning. It's so exciting. Then you can do crazy things with your money. And then
like, I feel like being, yeah, I feel like doing shit like Ocean's 11 and shit like that would be fun if we were just never caught.
It'd just be so fun to acquire it too.
And it would be fun to do it all together.
Exactly. Go team.
One more thing. This episode comes out the day after the Super Bowl.
So obviously I'm going to be voting for the Patriots. Kylie?
I'm going to be a hater. I'm going to go Seahawks.
All right.
I'm going to go Patriots because patriotic.
Fun fact, Kylie, I hate you for not going for the Patriots, first of all, but our quarterback played at UNC. So you would think North Carolinians, we'd stay together.
Well, there's someone I personally have beef with who plays on the Patriots.
Yes, but he actually did really good the last game. And I was going to text you and decided not to. So you're welcome.
Thank you. So everyone, I won't include his name, but we will be praying on the downfall of one specific Patriots player.
I will not for this game, but after this game, I will because he's probably going to get traded.
Good for him.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right.
I'm bored.
And Holly doesn't know what's going on. With that, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. For more information about the case, check us out on our social media or on our website at overmydeadpod.com. We will see you guys next week with another episode, and go Patriots.
Goodbye.
Bye.